decades, the traditional household division of labor has been demolished, not least in the name of liberation and freedom. That demolition, however, has not left so much glorious lack of restriction in its wake as chaos, conflict, and indeterminacy. The escape from tyranny is often followed not by paradise, but by a sojourn in the desert, aimless, confused, and deprived. Furthermore, in the absence of agreed-upon tradition, and the constraints, often uncomfortable, often even unreasonable, that it imposes, there exist only three difficult options: slavery, tyranny, or negotiation. The slave merely does what he or she is told, happy perhaps to shed the responsibility, and solves the problem of complexity in that manner. But it's a temporary solution. The spirit of the slave rebels. The tyrant merely tells the slave what to do and solves the problem of complexity in that manner. But it's a temporary solution. The tyrant tires of the slave. There's nothing and no one there except for predictable and sullen obedience. Who can live forever with that but negotiation? That requires forthright admission on the part of both players that the dragon exists. That's a reality difficult to face, even when it's still too small to simply devour the knight who dares confront it. Maybe the demolished couple could have more precisely specified their desired manner of being. Maybe in that manner they could have jointly prevented the waters of chaos from springing uncontrollably forth and drowning them. Maybe they could have done that instead of saying, in the agreeable, lazy, and cowardly way, "It's okay. It's not worth fighting about." There is little in a marriage that is so little that it is not worth fighting about. You're stuck in a marriage like the two proverbial cats in a barrel, bound by the oath that lasts in theory until one or both of you die. That oath is there to make you take the damn situation seriously. Do you really want the same petty annoyance tormenting you every single day of your marriage for the decades of its existence? Oh, I can put up with it, you think. And maybe you should. You're no paragon of genuine tolerance. And maybe if you brought up how your partner's giddy laugh is beginning to sound like nails on a blackboard, he or she would tell you, quite properly, to go to hell. And maybe the fault is with you, and you should grow up, get yourself together, and keep quiet. But perhaps braying like a donkey in the midst of a social gathering is not reflecting well on your partner, and you should stick to your guns. Under such circumstances, there is nothing but a fight with peace as the goal that will reveal the truth. But you remain silent, and you convince yourself it's because you are a good, peace-loving, patient person. And nothing could be further from the truth. And the monster under the rug gains a few more pounds. Maybe a forthright conversation about sexual dissatisfaction might have been the proverbial stitch in time. Not that it would be easy. Perhaps Madame desired the death of intimacy, clandestinely, because she was deeply and secretly ambivalent about sex. God knows there's reason to be. Perhaps Monsieur was a terrible, selfish lover. Maybe they both were. Sorting that out is worth a fight, isn't it? That's a big part of life, isn't it? Perhaps addressing that, and you never know, solving the problem, would be worth 2 months of pure misery just telling each other the truth. Not with intent to destroy or attain victory, because that's not the truth. That's just all-out war. Maybe it wasn't sex. Maybe every conversation between husband and wife had deteriorated into boring routine as no shared adventure animated the couple. Maybe that deterioration was easier moment by moment, day by day, than bearing the responsibility of keeping the relationship alive. Living things die, after all, without attention. Life is indistinguishable from effortful maintenance. No one finds a match so perfect that the need for continued attention and work vanishes, And, besides, if you found the perfect person, he or she would run away from ever so imperfect you in justifiable horror. In truth, what you need, what you deserve, after all, is someone exactly as imperfect as you. Maybe the husband who betrayed his wife was appallingly immature and selfish. Maybe that selfishness got the upper hand. Maybe she did not oppose this tendency with enough force and vigor. Maybe she could not agree with him on the proper disciplinary approach to the children and shut him out of their lives in consequence. Maybe that allowed him to circumvent what he saw as an unpleasant responsibility. Maybe hatred brewed in the hearts of the children, watching this underground battle, punished by the resentment of their mother and alienated, bit by bit, from good old dad. Maybe the dinners she prepared for him, or he for her, were cold and bitterly eaten. Maybe all that unaddressed conflict left both resentful in a manner unspoken but effectively enacted. Maybe all that unspoken trouble started to undermine the invisible networks that supported the marriage. Maybe respect slowly turned into contempt, and no one deigned to notice. Maybe love slowly turned into hate, without mention. Everything clarified and articulated becomes visible. Maybe neither wife nor husband wished to see or understand. Maybe they left things purposefully in the fog. Maybe they generated the fog to hide what they did not want to see. What did Mrs. gain when she turned from mistress to maid or mother? Was it a relief when her sex life disappeared? Could she complain more profitably to the neighbors and her mother when her husband turned away? Maybe that was more gratifying, secretly, than anything good that could be derived from any marriage, no matter how perfect. What can possibly compare to the pleasures of sophisticated and well-practiced martyrdom? She's such a saint, and married to such a terrible man, she deserved much better. That's a gratifying myth to live by, even if unconsciously chosen, the truth of the situation be damned. Maybe she never really liked her husband. Maybe she never really liked men and still doesn't. Maybe that was her mother's fault or her grandmother's. Maybe she mimicked their behavior, acting out their trouble, transmitted unconsciously, implicitly, down the generations. Maybe she was taking revenge on her father or her brother or society. What did her husband gain for his part when his sex life at home died? Did he willingly play along as martyr and complain bitterly to his friends? Did he use it as the excuse he wanted anyway to search for a new lover? Did he use it to justify the resentment he still felt towards women in general for the rejections he had faced so continuously before falling into his marriage? Did he seize the opportunity to get effortlessly fat and lazy because he wasn't desired in any case? Maybe both, wife and husband alike, used the opportunity to mess up their marriage to take revenge upon God, perhaps the one being who could have sorted through the mess. Here's the terrible truth about such matters. Every single voluntarily unprocessed and uncomprehended and ignored reason for marital failure will compound and conspire and will then plague that betrayed and self-betrayed woman for the rest of her life. The same goes for her husband. All she, he, they, or we must do to ensure such an outcome is nothing. Don't notice. Don't react. Don't attend. Don't discuss. Don't consider. Don't work for peace. Don't take responsibility. Don't confront the chaos and turn it into order. Just wait, anything but naive and innocent, for the chaos to rise up and engulf you instead. Why avoid when avoidance necessarily and inevitably poisons the future? Because the possibility of a monster lurks underneath all disagreements and errors. Maybe the fight you are having, or not having, with your wife or your husband signifies the beginning of the end of your relationship. Maybe your relationship is ending because you are a bad person. It's likely, at least in part, isn't it? Having the argument necessary to solve a real problem therefore necessitates willingness to confront two forms of miserable and dangerous potential simultaneously. Chaos, the potential fragility of the relationship, of all relationships, of life itself, and hell, the fact that you and your partner could each be the person bad enough to ruin everything with your laziness and spite. There's every motivation to avoid, but it doesn't help. Why remain vague when it renders life stagnant and murky? Well, if you don't know who you are, you can hide in doubt. Maybe you're not a bad, careless, worthless person. Who knows? Not you. Particularly if you refuse to think about it, and you have every reason not to. But not thinking about something you don't want to know about doesn't make it go away. You are merely trading specific, particular, pointed knowledge of the likely finite list of your real faults and flaws for a much longer list of undefined potential inadequacies and insufficiencies. Why refuse to investigate when knowledge of reality enables mastery of reality? And, if not mastery, at least the stature of an honest amateur. Well, what if there truly is something rotten in the state of Denmark? Then what? Isn't it better under such conditions to live in willful blindness and enjoy the bliss of ignorance? Well, not if the monster is real. Do you truly think it is a good idea to retreat, to abandon the possibility of arming yourself against the rising sea of troubles and to thereby diminish yourself in your own eyes? Do you truly think it wise to let the catastrophe grow in the shadows while you shrink and decrease and become ever more afraid? Isn't it better to prepare, to sharpen your sword, to peer into the darkness, and then to beard the lion in its den? Maybe you'll get hurt. Probably you'll get hurt. Life, after all, is suffering. But maybe the wound won't be fatal. If you wait instead until what you are refusing to investigate comes a knocking at your door, things will certainly not go so well for you. What you least want will inevitably happen, and when you are least prepared. What you least want to encounter will make itself manifest when you are weakest and it is strongest, and you will be defeated. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. William Butler Yeats, The Second Coming. Why refuse to specify when specifying the problem would enable its solution? Because to specify the problem is to admit that it exists. Because to specify the problem is to allow yourself to know what you want, say, from friend or lover, and then you will know precisely and cleanly when you don't get it, and that will hurt sharply and specifically. But you will learn something from that, and use what you learn in the future. And the alternative to that single sharp pain is the dull ache of continued hopelessness and vague failure, and the sense that time, precious time, is slipping by. Why refuse to specify? Because while you are failing to define success, and thereby rendering it impossible, you are also refusing to define failure to yourself, so that if and when you fail, you won't notice, and it won't hurt. But that won't work. You cannot be fooled so easily unless you have gone very far down the road. You will instead carry with you a continual sense of disappointment in your own being, and the self-contempt that comes along with that, and the increasing hatred for the world that all of that generates or degenerates. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again, but now I know the 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. What if she who has been betrayed, now driven by desperation, is now determined to face all the incoherence of past, present, and future? What if she decided to sort through the mess, even though she has avoided doing so until now, and is all the weaker and more confused for it? Perhaps the effort will nearly kill her, but she is now on a path worse than death in any case. To reemerge, to escape, to be reborn, she must thoughtfully articulate the reality she comfortably but dangerously left hidden behind a veil of ignorance and the pretense of peace. She must separate the particular details of her specific catastrophe from the intolerable general condition of being in a world where everything has fallen apart. Everything. That's far too much. It was specific things that fell apart, not everything. Identifiable beliefs failed. Particular actions were false and inauthentic. What were they? How can they be fixed now? How can she be better in the future? She will never return to dry land if she refuses or is unable to figure it all out. She can put the world back together by some precision of thought, some precision of speech, some reliance on her word, some reliance on the word. But perhaps it's better to leave things in the fog. Perhaps by now there just isn't enough left of her. Perhaps too much of her has been left unrevealed, undeveloped. Maybe she simply no longer has the energy. Some earlier care and courage and honesty and expression might have saved her from all this trouble. What if she had communicated her unhappiness with the decline of her romantic life right when it started to decline, precisely, exactly when that decline first bothered her? Or, if it didn't bother her, what if she had instead communicated the fact it didn't bother her as much as it perhaps should have? What if she had clearly and carefully confronted the fact of her husband's contempt for her household efforts? Would she have discovered her resentment of her father and society itself, and the consequent contamination of her relationships? What if she had fixed all that? How much stronger would she then have become? How much less likely to avoid facing up to difficulties in consequence? How might she then have served herself, her family, and the world? What if she had continually and honestly risked conflict in the present, in the service of longer-term truth and peace? What if she had treated the micro-collapses of her marriage as evidence of an underlying instability eminently worthy of attention, instead of ignoring them, putting up with them, or smiling through them in such a nice, agreeable manner? Maybe she would be different, and her husband different too. Maybe they would still be married, formally and in spirit. Maybe they would both be much younger, physically and mentally, than they are now. Maybe her house would have been founded more on rock and less on sand. When things fall apart and chaos reemerges, we can give structure to it and reestablish order through our speech. If we speak carefully and precisely, we can sort things out and put them in their proper place and set a new goal and navigate to it. Often, communally, if we negotiate, if we reach consensus. If we speak carelessly and imprecisely, however, things remain vague. The destination remains unproclaimed. The fog of uncertainty does not lift, and there is no negotiating through the world. The construction of soul and world. The psyche, the soul, and the world are both organized at the highest level of human existence with language through communication. Things are not as they appear when the outcome has been neither intended nor desired. Being has not been sorted into its proper categories when it is not behaving. When something goes wrong, even perception itself must be questioned, along with evaluation, thought, and action. When error announces itself, undifferentiated chaos is at hand. Its reptilian form paralyzes and confuses. But dragons, which do exist, perhaps more than anything else exists, also hoard gold. In that collapse, into the terrible mess of uncomprehended being, lurks the possibility of new and benevolent order. Clarity of thought, courageous clarity of thought, is necessary to call it forth. The problem itself must be admitted to, as close to the time of its emergence as possible. "I'm unhappy" is a good start, not "I have a right to be unhappy," because that is still questionable at the beginning of the problem-solving process. Perhaps your unhappiness is justified under the current circumstances. Perhaps any reasonable person would be displeased and miserable to be where you are. Alternatively, perhaps, you are just whiny and immature. Consider both at least equally probable, as terrible as such consideration might appear. Just exactly how immature might you be? There's a potentially bottomless pit, but at least you might rectify it, if you can admit to it. We parse the complex, tangled chaos and specify the nature of things, including ourselves. It is in this way that our creative, communicative exploration continually generates and regenerates the world. We are shaped and informed by what we voluntarily encounter, and we shape what we inhabit as well in that encounter. This is difficult, but the difficulty is not relevant, because the alternative is worse. Maybe our errant husband ignored the dinner conversation of his wife because he hated his job and was tired and resentful. Maybe he hated his job because his career was forced on him by his father and he was too weak or loyal to object. Maybe she put up with his lack of attention because she believed that forthright objection itself was rude and immoral. Maybe she hated her own father's anger and decided when very young that all aggression and assertiveness were morally wrong. Maybe she thought her husband wouldn't love her if she had any opinions of her own. It is very difficult to put such things in order, but damaged machinery will continue to malfunction if its problems are neither diagnosed nor fixed. Wheat from chaff. Precision specifies. When something terrible happens, it is precision that separates the unique terrible thing that has actually happened from all the other equally terrible things that might have happened but did not. If you wake up in pain, you might be dying. You might be dying slowly and terribly from one of a diverse number of painful, horrible diseases. If you refuse to tell your doctor about your pain, then what you have is unspecified. It could be any of those diseases, and it certainly, since you have avoided the diagnostic conversation, the act of articulation, is something unspeakable. But if you talk to your doctor, all those terrible possible diseases will collapse, with luck, into just one terrible or not so terrible disease, or even into nothing. Then you can laugh at your previous fears. And if something really is wrong, well, you're prepared. Precision may leave the tragedy intact, but it chases away the ghouls and the demons. What you hear in the forest, but cannot see, might be a tiger. It might even be a conspiracy of tigers, each hungrier and more vicious than the other, led by a crocodile. But it might not be, too. If you turn and look, perhaps you'll see that it's just a squirrel. I know someone who was actually chased by a squirrel. Something is out there in the woods. You know that with certainty. But often, it's only a squirrel. If you refuse to look, however, then it's a dragon, and you're no knight. You're a mouse confronting a lion, a rabbit paralyzed by the gaze of a wolf. And I am not saying that it's always a squirrel. Often, it's something truly terrible. But even what is terrible in actuality often pales in significance compared to what is terrible in imagination. And often what cannot be confronted because of its horror in imagination can in fact be confronted when reduced to its still admittedly terrible actuality. If you shirk the responsibility of confronting the unexpected, even when it appears in manageable doses, reality itself will become unsustainably disorganized and chaotic. Then it will grow bigger and swallow all order, all sense, and all predictability. Ignored reality transforms itself, reverts back into the great goddess of chaos, the great reptilian monster of the unknown, the great predatory beast against which mankind has struggled since the dawn of time. If the gap between pretense and reality goes unmentioned, it will widen. You will fall into it, and the consequences will not be good. Ignored reality manifests itself in an abyss of confusion and suffering. Be careful with what you tell yourself and others about what you have done, what you are doing, and where you are going. Search for the correct words. Organize those words into the correct sentences and those sentences into the correct paragraphs. The past can be redeemed when reduced by precise language to its essence. The present can flow by without robbing the future if its realities are spoken out clearly. With careful thought and language, the singular stellar destiny that justifies existence can be extracted from the multitude of murky and unpleasant futures that are far more likely to manifest themselves of their own accord. This is how the I and the Word make habitable order. Don't hide baby monsters under the carpet. They will flourish. They will grow large in the dark. Then, when you least expect it, they will jump out and devour you. You will descend into an indeterminate, confusing hell instead of ascending into the heaven of virtue and clarity. Courageous and truthful words will render your reality simple, pristine, well-defined, and habitable. If you identify things with careful attention and language, you bring them forward as viable, obedient objects, detaching them from their underlying near-universal interconnectedness. You simplify them. You make them specific and useful and reduce their complexity. You make it possible to live with them and use them without dying from that complexity with its attendant uncertainty and anxiety. If you leave things vague, then you'll never know what is one thing and what is another. Everything will bleed into everything else. This makes the world too complex to be managed. You have to consciously define the topic of a conversation, particularly when it is difficult, or it becomes about everything, and everything is too much. This is so frequently why couples cease communicating. Every argument degenerates into every problem that ever emerged in the past, every problem that exists now, and every terrible thing that is likely to happen in the future. No one can have a discussion about everything. Instead, you can say, "This exact, precise thing, that is what is making me unhappy. This exact, precise thing, that is what I want," as an alternative, although I am open to suggestions if they are specific. "This exact, precise thing, that is what you could deliver so that I will stop making your life and mine miserable." But to do that, you have to think, what is wrong exactly? What do I want exactly? You must speak forthrightly and call forth the habitable world from chaos. You must use honest, precise speech to do that. If, instead, you shrink away and hide, what you are hiding from will transform itself into the giant dragon that lurks under your bed and in your forest and in the dark recesses of your mind, and it will devour you. You must determine where you have been in your life so that you can know where you are now. If you don't know where you are, precisely, then you could be anywhere. anywhere is too many places to be, and some of those places are very bad. You must determine where you have been in your life, because otherwise you can't get to where you're going. You can't get from point A to point B unless you are already at point A. And if you're just anywhere, the chances you are at point A are very small indeed. You must determine where you are going in your life, because you cannot get there unless you move in that direction. Random wandering will not move you forward. It will instead disappoint and frustrate you and make you anxious and unhappy and hard to get along with, and then resentful, and then vengeful, and then worse. Say what you mean, so that you can find out what you mean. Act out what you say, so you can find out what happens. Then, pay attention. Note your errors. Articulate them. Strive to correct them. That is how you discover the meaning of your life. That will protect you from the tragedy of your life. How could it be otherwise? Confront the chaos of being. Take aim against a sea of troubles. Specify your destination and chart your course. Admit to what you want. Tell those around you who you are. Narrow and gaze attentively and move forward. Forthrightly. Be precise in your speech. Rule 11. Do not bother children when they are skateboarding. Danger and mastery. There was a time when kids skateboarded on the west side of Sydney Smith Hall at the University of Toronto, where I work. Sometimes I stood there and watched them. There are rough, wide, shallow concrete steps there, leading up from the street to the front entrance, accompanied by tubular iron handrails about 2.5 inches in diameter and 20 feet long. The crazy kids, almost always boys, would pull back about 15 yards from the top of the steps. Then they would place a foot on their boards and skate like mad to get up some speed. Just before they collided with the handrail, they would reach down, grab their board with a single hand, and jump onto the top of the rail, board sliding their way down its length, propelling themselves off and landing, sometimes gracefully, still atop their boards, sometimes painfully off them. Either way, they were soon back at it. Some might call that stupid. Maybe it was, but it was brave, too. I thought those kids were amazing. I thought they deserved a pat on the back and some honest admiration. Of course it was dangerous. Danger was the point. They wanted to triumph over danger. They would have been safer in protective equipment, but that would have ruined it. They weren't trying to be safe. They were trying to become competent. And it's competence that makes people as safe as they can truly be. I wouldn't dare do what those kids were doing. Not only that, I couldn't. I certainly couldn't climb a construction crane, like a certain type of modern daredevil evident on YouTube, and, of course, people who work on construction cranes. I don't like heights, although the 25,000 feet to which airliners ascend is so high that it doesn't bother me. I have flown several times in a carbon fiber stunt plane, even doing a hammerhead roll, and that was okay, although it's very physically and mentally demanding. To perform a hammerhead roll, you pilot the plane straight up vertically until the force of gravity makes it stall. Then it falls backwards, corkscrewing, until eventually it flips and noses straight down, after which you pull out of the dive, or you don't do another hammerhead roll. But I can't skateboard, especially down handrails, and I can't climb cranes. Sydney Smith Hall faces another street on the east side. Along that street, named St. George, ironically enough, the university installed a series of rough, hard-edged concrete plant boxes sloping down to the roadway. The kids used to go out there, too, and board slide along the box edges, as they did along the concrete surround of a sculpture adjacent to the building. That didn't last very long. Little steel brackets known as skate stoppers soon appeared every 2 or 3 feet along those edges. When I first saw them, I remembered something that happened in Toronto several years previously. 2 weeks before elementary school classes started throughout the city, all the playground equipment disappeared. The legislation governing such things had changed, and there was a panic about insurability. The playgrounds were hastily removed, even though they were sufficiently safe, grandfathered re their insurability, and often paid for, and quite recently, by parents. This meant no playgrounds at all for more than a year. During this time, I often saw bored but admirable kids charging around on the roof of our local school. It was that or scrounge about in the dirt with the cats and the less adventurous children. I say sufficiently safe about the demolished playgrounds because when playgrounds are made too safe, kids either stop playing in them or start playing in unintended ways. Kids need playgrounds dangerous enough to remain challenging. People, including children, who are people too, after all, don't seek to minimize risk. They seek to optimize it. They drive and walk and love and play so that they achieve what they desire. But they push themselves a bit at the same time, too, so they continue to develop. Thus, if things are made too safe, people, including children, start to figure out ways to make them dangerous again. When untrammeled and encouraged, we prefer to live on the edge. There, we can still be both confident in our experience and confronting the chaos that helps us develop. We're hardwired for that reason to enjoy risk, some of us more than others. We feel invigorated and excited when we work to optimize our future performance while playing in the present. Otherwise, we lumber around sloth-like, unconscious, unformed, and careless. Overprotected, we will fail when something dangerous, unexpected, and full of opportunity suddenly makes its appearance, as it inevitably will. The skate stoppers are unattractive. The surround of the nearby sculpture would have to have been badly damaged by diligent board sliders before it would look as mean as it does now, studded with metal like a pit bull's collar. The large plant boxes have metal guards placed at irregular intervals across their tops, and this, in addition to the wear caused by the skateboarders, produces a dismal impression of poor design, resentment, and badly executed afterthoughts. It gives the area, which was supposed to be beautified by the sculpture and vegetation, a generic industrial-slash-prison-slash-mental-institution-slash-work-camp look of the kind that appears when builders and public officials do not like or trust the people they serve. The sheer, harsh ugliness of the solution makes a lie of the reasons for its implementation. Success and resentment. If you read the depth psychologists, Freud and Jung, for example, as well as their precursor, Friedrich Nietzsche, you learn that there is a dark side to everything. Freud delved deeply into the latent, implicit content of dreams, which were often aimed, in his opinion, at the expression of some improper wish. Jung believed that every act of social propriety was accompanied by its evil twin, its unconscious shadow. Nietzsche investigated the role played by what he termed ressentiment in motivating what were ostensibly selfless actions, and often exhibited all too publicly. For that man be delivered from revenge, that is for me the bridge to the highest hope, and a rainbow after long storms. The tarantulas, of course, would have it otherwise. What justice means to us is precisely that the world be filled with the storms of our revenge. Thus they speak to each other. We shall wreak vengeance and abuse on all whose equals we are not. Thus do the tarantula hearts vow. And will to equality shall henceforth be the name for virtue. And against all that has power, we want to raise our clamor. You preachers of equality, the tyrant mania of impotence clamors thus out of you for equality. Your most secret ambitions to be tyrants thus shroud themselves in words of virtue. The incomparable English essayist George Orwell knew this sort of thing well. In 1937, he wrote The Road to Wigan Pier, which was in part a scathing attack on upper-class British socialists. This, despite being inclined towards socialism himself. In the first half of this book, Orwell portrays the appalling conditions faced by UK miners in the 1930s. Several dentists have told me that in industrial districts, a person over 30 with any of his or her own teeth is coming to be an abnormality. In Wigan, various people gave me their opinion that it is best to get shut of your teeth as early in life as possible. "Teeth is just a misery," one woman said to me. A Wigan Pier coal miner had to walk, crawl would be a better word given the height of the mine shafts, up to 3 miles underground in the dark, banging his head and scraping his back, just to get to his 7.5-hour shift of back-breaking work. After that, he crawled back. It is comparable, perhaps, to climbing a smallish mountain before and after your day's work, stated Orwell. None of the time spent crawling was paid. Orwell wrote The Road to Wigan Pier for the Left Book Club, a socialist publishing group that released a select volume every month. After reading the first half of his book, which deals directly with the miners' personal circumstances, it is impossible not to feel sympathy for the working poor. Only a monster could keep his heart hardened through the accounts of the lives Orwell describes. It is not long since conditions in the mines were worse than they are now. There are still living a few very old women who in their youth have worked underground, crawling on all fours and dragging tubs of coal. They used to go on doing this even when they were pregnant. In the book's second half, however, Orwell turned his gaze to a different problem, the comparative unpopularity of socialism in the UK at the time, despite the clear and painful inequity observable everywhere. He concluded that the tweed-wearing, armchair-philosophizing, victim-identifying, pity-and-contempt-dispensing social reformer types frequently did not like the poor, as they claimed. Instead, they just hated the rich. They disguised their resentment and jealousy with piety, sanctimony, and self-righteousness, things in the unconscious, or on the social justice-dispensing leftist front, haven't changed much today. It is because of Freud, Jung, Nietzsche, and Orwell that I always wonder, what then do you stand against whenever I hear someone say, too loudly, "I stand for this"? The question seems particularly relevant if the same someone is complaining, criticizing, or trying to change someone else's behavior. I believe it was Jung who developed the most surgically wicked of psychoanalytic dicta. If you cannot understand why someone did something, look at the consequences and infer the motivation. This is a psychological scalpel. It's not always a suitable instrument. It can cut too deeply or in the wrong places. It is, perhaps, a last resort option. Nonetheless, there are times when its application proves enlightening. If the consequences of placing skate stoppers on plant boxes and sculpture bases, for example, is unhappy adolescent males and brutalist aesthetic disregard of beauty, then perhaps that was the aim. When someone claims to be acting from the highest principles for the good of others, there is no reason to assume that the person's motives are genuine. People motivated to make things better usually aren't concerned with changing other people, or if they are, they take responsibility for making the same changes to themselves, and first. Beneath the production of rules stopping the skateboarders from doing highly skilled, courageous, and dangerous things, I see the operation of an insidious and profoundly anti-human spirit. More about Chris. My friend Chris, whom I wrote about earlier, was possessed by such a spirit, to the serious detriment of his mental health. Part of what plagued him was guilt. He attended elementary and junior high school in a number of towns up in the frigid expanses of the northernmost Alberta prairie, prior to ending up in the Fairview I wrote about earlier. Fights with native kids were a too common part of his experience during those moves. It's no overstatement to point out that such kids were, on average, rougher than the white kids, or that they were touchier, and they had their reasons. I knew this well from my own experience. I had a rocky friendship with a Métis kid, René Heck, when I was in elementary school. It was rocky because the situation was complex. There was a large cultural divide between René and me. His clothes were dirtier. He was rougher in speech and attitude. I had skipped a grade in school and was, in addition, small for my age. René was a big, smart, good-looking kid, and he was tough. We were in grade 6 together in a class taught by my father. René was caught chewing gum. "René," said my father, "spit that gum out. You look like a cow." "Ha ha," I laughed under my breath. "René the cow." René might have been a cow, but there was nothing wrong with his hearing. "Peterson," he said, "after school, you're dead." Earlier in the morning, René and I had arranged to see a movie that night at the local movie theater, The Gem. It looked like that was off. In any case, the rest of the day passed quickly and unpleasantly, as it does when threat and pain lurk. René was more than capable of giving me a good pounding. After school, I took off for the bike stands outside the school as fast as I could, but René beat me there. We circled around the bikes, him on one side, me on the other. We were characters in a Keystone Cops short. As long as I kept circling, he couldn't catch me. But my strategy couldn't work forever. I yelled out that I was sorry, but he wasn't mollified. His pride was hurt, and he wanted me to pay. I crouched down and hid behind some bikes, keeping an eye on René. "René," I yelled, "I'm sorry I called you a cow. Let's quit fighting." He started to approach me again. I said, "René, I'm sorry I said that, really, and I still want to go to the movie with you." This wasn't just a tactic. I meant it. Otherwise, what happened next would not have happened. René stopped circling. Then he stared at me. Then he broke into tears. Then he ran off. That was native-white relationships in a nutshell in our hard little town. We never did go to a movie together. When my friend Chris got into it with native kids, he wouldn't fight back. He didn't feel that his self-defense was morally justified, so he took his beatings. "We took their land," he later wrote. "That was wrong. No wonder they're angry." Over time, step by step, Chris withdrew from the world. It was partly his guilt. He developed a deep hatred for masculinity and masculine activity. He saw going to school or working or finding a girlfriend as part of the same process that had led to the colonization of North America, the horrible nuclear stalemate of the Cold War, and the despoiling of the planet. He had read some books about Buddhism and felt that negation of his own being was ethically required in the light of the current world situation. He came to believe that the same applied to others. When I was an undergraduate, Chris was, for a while, one of my roommates. One late night, we went to a local bar. We walked home afterward. He started to snap the side view mirrors off parked cars, one after the other. I said, "Quit that, Chris. What possible good is it going to do to make the people who own these cars miserable?" He told me that they were all part of the frenetic human activity that was ruining everything, and that they deserved whatever they got. I said that taking revenge on people who were just living normal lives was not going to help anything. Years later, when I was in graduate school in Montreal, Chris showed up for what was supposed to be a visit. He was aimless, however, and lost. He asked if I could help. He ended up moving in. I was married by then, living with my wife Tammy and our year-old daughter, Michaela. Chris had also been friends with Tammy back in Fairview and held out hopes of more than friendship. That complicated the situation even more, but not precisely in the manner you might think. Chris started by hating men, but he ended by hating women. He wanted them, but he had rejected education and career and desire. He smoked heavily and was unemployed. Unsurprisingly, therefore, he was not of much interest to women. That made him bitter. I tried to convince him that the path he had chosen was only going to lead to further ruin. He needed to develop some humility. He needed to get a life. One evening, it was Chris's turn to make dinner. When my wife came home, the apartment was filled with smoke. Hamburgers were burning furiously in the frying pan. Chris was on his hands and knees, attempting to repair something that had come loose on the legs of the stove. My wife knew his tricks. She knew he was burning dinner on purpose. He resented having to make it. He resented the feminine role, even though the household duties were split in a reasonable manner, even though he knew that perfectly well. He was fixing the stove to provide a plausible, even creditable, excuse for burning the food. When she pointed out what he was doing, he played the victim, but he was deeply and dangerously furious. Part of him, and not the good part, was convinced that he was smarter than anyone else. It was a blow to his pride that she could see through his tricks. It was an ugly situation. Tammy and I took a walk up towards a local park the next day. We needed to get away from the apartment, although it was 35 below, bitterly, frigidly cold, humid, and foggy. It was windy. It was hostile to life. Living with Chris was too much, Tammy said. We entered the park. Trees forked their bare branches upward through the damp gray air. A black squirrel, tail hairless from mange, gripped a leafless branch, shivered violently, struggling to hold on against the wind. What was it doing out there in the cold? Squirrels are partial hibernators. They only come out in the winter when it's warm. Then we saw another, and another, and another, and another, and another. There were squirrels all around us in the park, all partially hairless, tails and bodies alike, all wind-blown on their branches, all shaking and freezing in the deathly cold. No one else was around. It was impossible. It was inexplicable. It was exactly appropriate. We were on the stage of an absurdist play. It was directed by God. Tammy left soon after with our daughter for a few days elsewhere. Near Christmas time that same year, my younger brother and his new wife came out to visit from Western Canada. My brother also knew Chris. They all put on their winter clothes in preparation for a walk around downtown Montreal. Chris put on a long, dark winter coat. He pulled a black toque, a brimless knitted cap, far down over his head. His coat was black, as were his pants and boots. He was very tall and thin, and somewhat stooped. "Chris," I joked, "you look like a serial killer." "Ha, bloody ha." The three came back from their walk. Chris was out of sorts. There were strangers in his territory. Another happy couple. It was salt in his wounds. We had dinner, pleasantly enough. We talked and ended the evening. But I couldn't sleep. Something wasn't right. It was in the air. At 4 in the morning, I had had enough. Crawled out of bed. I knocked quietly on Chris's door and went, without waiting for an answer, into his room. He was awake on the bed, staring at the ceiling, as I knew he would be. I sat down beside him. I knew him very well. I talked him down from his murderous rage. Then I went back to bed and slept. The next morning, my brother pulled me aside. He wanted to speak with me. We sat down. He said, "What the hell was going on last night? I couldn't sleep at all. Was something wrong?" I told my brother that Chris wasn't doing so well. I didn't tell him that he was lucky to be alive, that we all were. The spirit of Cain had visited our house, but we were left unscathed. Maybe I picked up some change in scent that night when death hung in the air. Chris had a very bitter odor. He showered frequently, but the towels and the sheets picked up the smell. It was impossible to get them clean. It was the product of a psyche and a body that did not operate harmoniously. A social worker I knew, who also knew Chris, told me of her familiarity with that odor. Everyone at her workplace knew of it, although they only discussed it in hushed tones. They called it the smell of the unemployable. Soon after this, I finished my postdoctoral studies. Tammy and I moved away from Montreal to Boston. We had our second baby. Now and then, Chris and I talked on the phone. He came to visit once. It went well. He had found a job at an auto parts place. He was trying to make things better. He was okay at that point. But it didn't last. I didn't see him in Boston again. Almost 10 years later, the night before Chris's 40th birthday, as it happened, he called me again. By this time, I had moved my family to Toronto. He had some news. A story he had written was going to be published in a collection put together by a small but legitimate press. He wanted to tell me that. He wrote good short stories. I had read them all. We had discussed them at length. He was a good photographer, too. He had a good creative eye. The next day, Chris drove his old pickup, the same battered beast from Fairview, into the bush. He ran a hose from the exhaust pipe into the front cab. I can see him there, looking through the cracked windshield, smoking, waiting. They found his body a few weeks later. I called his dad. "My beautiful boy," he sobbed. Recently, I was invited to give a TEDx talk at a nearby university. Another professor talked first. He had been invited to speak because of his work, his genuinely fascinating technical work with computationally intelligent surfaces, like computer touchscreens, but capable of being placed everywhere. He spoke, instead, about the threat human beings posed to the survival of the planet. Like Chris, like far too many people, he had become anti-human to the core. He had not walked as far down that road as my friend, but the same dread spirit animated them both. He stood in front of a screen displaying an endless slow pan of a blocks-long Chinese high-tech factory. Hundreds of white-suited workers stood like sterile, inhuman robots behind their assembly lines, soundlessly inserting piece A into slot B. He told the audience, filled with bright young people, of the decision he and his wife had made to limit their number of children to one. He told them it was something they should all consider if they wanted to regard themselves as ethical people. I felt that such a decision was properly considered, but only in his particular case, where less than one might have even been better. The many Chinese students in attendance sat stolidly through his moralizing. They thought, perhaps, of their parents' escape from the horrors of Mao's cultural revolution and its one-child policy. They thought, perhaps, of the vast improvement in living standard and freedom provided by the very same factories. A couple of them said as much in the question period that followed. Would have the professor reconsidered his opinions if he knew where such ideas can lead? I would like to say yes. But I don't believe it. I think he could have known, but refused to. Worse, perhaps, he knew, but didn't care, or knew, and was headed there voluntarily in any case. Self-appointed judges of the human race. It has not been long since the earth seemed infinitely larger than the people who inhabited it. It was only in the late 1800s that the brilliant biologist Thomas Huxley, 1825 to 95, staunch defender of Darwin and Aldous Huxley's grandfather, told the British Parliament that it was literally impossible for mankind to exhaust the oceans. Their power of generation was simply too great, as far as he could determine, compared to even the most assiduous human predations. It's been an even shorter 50 years since Rachel Carson's Silent Spring ignited the environmental movement. 50 years. That's nothing. That's not even yesterday. We've only just developed the conceptual tools and technologies that allow us to understand the web of life, however imperfectly. We deserve a bit of sympathy, in consequence, for the hypothetical outrage of our destructive behavior. Sometimes we don't know any better. Sometimes we do know better, but haven't yet formulated any practical alternatives. It's not as if life is easy for human beings, after all, even now. And it's only a few decades ago that the majority of human beings were starving, diseased, and illiterate. Wealthy as we are, increasingly everywhere, we still only live decades that can be counted on our fingers. Even at present, it is the rare and fortunate family that does not contain at least one member with a serious illness, and all will face that problem eventually. We do what we can to make the best of things in our vulnerability and fragility, and the planet is harder on us than we are on it. We could cut ourselves some slack. Human beings are, after all, seriously remarkable creatures. We have no peers, and it's not clear that we have any real limits. Things happen now that appeared humanly impossible, even at the same time in the recent past when we began to wake up to our planet-sized responsibilities. A few weeks before writing this, I happened across two videos juxtaposed on YouTube. One showed the Olympic gold medal vault from 1956. The other, the Olympic silver medal vault from 2012. It didn't even look like the same sport or the same animal. What Michaela Maroney did in 2012 would have been considered superhuman in the 50s. Parkour, a sport derived from French military obstacle course training, is amazing, as is free running. I watch compilations of such performances with unabashed admiration. Some of the kids jump off three-story buildings without injury. It's dangerous and amazing. Crane climbers are so brave it rattles the mind. The same goes for extreme mountain bikers, freestyle snowboarders, surfers of 50-foot waves, and skateboarders. The boys who shot up Columbine High School, whom we discussed earlier, had appointed themselves judges of the human race, like the TEDx professor, although much more extreme, like Chris, my doomed friend. For Eric Harris, the more literate of the two killers, human beings were a failed and corrupt species. Once a presupposition such as that is accepted, its inner logic will inevitably manifest itself. If something is a plague, as David Attenborough has it, or a cancer, as the Club of Rome claimed, the person who eradicates it is a hero, a veritable planetary savior in this case. A real messiah might follow through with his rigorous moral logic and eliminate himself as well. This is what mass murderers, driven by near infinite resentment, typically do. Even their own being does not justify the existence of humanity. In fact, they kill themselves precisely to demonstrate the purity of their commitment to annihilation. No one in the modern world may, without objection, express the opinion that existence would be bettered by the absence of Jews, blacks, Muslims, or Englishmen. Why, then, is it virtuous to propose that the planet might be better off if there were fewer people on it? I can't help but see a skeletal, grinning face, gleeful at the possibility of the apocalypse, hiding not so very far behind such statements. And why does it so often seem to be the very people standing so visibly against prejudice who so often appear to feel obligated to denounce humanity itself? I have seen university students, particularly those in the humanities, suffer genuine declines in their mental health from being philosophically berated by such defenders of the planet for their existence as members of the human species. It's worse, I think, for young men. As privileged beneficiaries of the patriarchy, their accomplishments are considered unearned. As possible adherents of rape culture, they're sexually suspect. Their ambitions make them plunderers of the planet. They're not welcome. At the junior high, high school, and university level, they're falling behind educationally. When my son was 14, we discussed his grades. He was doing very well, he said, matter-of-factly, for a boy. I inquired further. Everyone knew, he said, that girls do better in school than boys. His intonation indicated surprise at my ignorance of something so self-evident. While writing this, I received the latest edition of The Economist. The cover story? The weaker sex, meaning males. In modern universities, women now make up more than 50% of the students in more than two-thirds of all disciplines. Boys are suffering in the modern world. They are more disobedient, negatively, or more independent, positively, than girls, and they suffer for this throughout their pre-university educational career. They are less agreeable, agreeableness being a personality trait associated with compassion, empathy, and avoidance of conflict, and less susceptible to anxiety and depression, at least after both sexes hit puberty. Boys' interests tilt towards things. Girls' interests tilt towards people. Strikingly, these differences, strongly influenced by biological factors, are most pronounced in the Scandinavian societies where gender equality has been pushed hardest. This is the opposite of what would be expected by those who insist ever more loudly that gender is a social construct. It isn't. This isn't a debate. The data are in. Boys like competition, and they don't like to obey, particularly when they are adolescents. During that time, they are driven to escape their families and establish their own independent existence. There's little difference between doing that and challenging authority. Schools, which were set up in the late 1800s precisely to inculcate obedience, do not take kindly to provocative and daring behavior, no matter how tough-minded and competent it might show a boy or a girl to be. Other factors play their role in the decline of boys. Girls will, for example, play boys' games, but boys are much more reluctant to play girls' games. This is, in part, because it is admirable for a girl to win when competing with a boy. It is also okay for her to lose to a boy. For a boy to beat a girl, however, it is often not okay, and just as often it is even less okay for him to lose. Imagine that a boy and girl, aged 9, get into a fight. Just for engaging, the boy is highly suspect. If he wins, he's pathetic. If he loses, well, his life might as well be over. Beat up by a girl. Girls can win by winning in their own hierarchy, by being good at what girls value as girls. They can add to this victory by winning in the boys' hierarchy. Boys, however, can only win by winning in the male hierarchy. They will lose status among girls and boys by being good at what girls value. It costs them in reputation among the boys and in attractiveness among the girls. Girls aren't attracted to boys who are their friends, even though they might like them, whatever that means. They are attracted to boys who win status contests with other boys. If you're male, however, you just can't hammer a female as hard as you would a male. Boys can't, won't, play truly competitive games with girls. It isn't clear how they can win. As the game turns into a girls' game, therefore, the boys leave. Are the universities, particularly the humanities, about to become a girls' game? Is this what we want? The situation in the universities and in educational institutions in general is far more problematic than the basic statistics indicate. If you eliminate the so-called STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics programs, excluding psychology, the female-to-male ratio is even more skewed. Almost 80% of students majoring in the fields of healthcare, public administration, psychology, and education, which comprise one quarter of all degrees, are female. The disparity is still rapidly increasing. At this rate, there will be very few men in most university disciplines in 15 years. This is not good news for men. It might even be catastrophic news for men. But it's also not good news for women. Career and marriage. The women at female-dominated institutes of higher education are finding it increasingly difficult to arrange a dating relationship of even moderate duration. In consequence, they must settle, if inclined, for a hookup or sequential hookups. Perhaps this is a move forward in terms of sexual liberation, but I doubt it. I think it's terrible for the girls. A stable, loving relationship is highly desirable for men as well as women. For women, however, it is often what is most wanted. From 1997 to 2012, according to the Pew Research Center, the number of women aged 18 to 34 who said that a successful marriage is one of the most important things in life rose from 28 to 37%, an increase of more than 30%. The number of young men who said the same thing declined 15% over the same period, from 35 to 29%. During that time, the proportion of married people over 18 continued to decline, down from three-quarters in 1960 to half now. Finally, among never-married adults aged 30 to 59, men are three times as likely as women to say they do not ever want to marry, 27 versus 8%. Who decided, anyway, that career is more important than love and family? Is working 80 hours a week at a high-end law firm truly worth the sacrifices required for that kind of success? And if it is worth it, why is it worth it? A minority of people, mostly men who score low in the trait of agreeableness, again, are hyper-competitive and want to win at any cost. A minority will find the work intrinsically fascinating, but most aren't, and most won't. And money doesn't seem to improve people's lives once they have enough to avoid the bill collectors. Furthermore, most high-performing and high-earning females have high-performing and high-earning partners, and that matters more to women. The Pew data also indicate that a spouse with a desirable job is a high priority for almost 80% of never-married but marriage-seeking women, but for less than 50% of men. When they hit their 30s, most of the top-rate female lawyers bail out of their high-pressure careers. Only 15% of equity partners at the 200 biggest U.S. law firms are women. This figure hasn't changed much in the last 15 years, even though female associates and staff attorneys are plentiful. It also isn't because the law firms don't want the women to stay around and succeed. There is a chronic shortage of excellent people, regardless of sex, and law firms are desperate to retain them. The women who leave want a job and a life that allows them some time. After law school and articling and the few first years of work, they develop other interests. This is common knowledge in the big firms, although it is not something that people are comfortable articulating in public, men and women alike. I recently watched a McGill University professor, female, lecture a room full of female law partners or near partners about how lack of childcare facilities and male definitions of success impeded their career progress and caused women to leave. I knew most of the women in the room. We had talked at great length. I knew they knew that none of this was at all the problem. They had nannies, and they could afford them. They had already outsourced all their domestic obligations and necessities. They understood as well, and perfectly well, that it was the market that defined success, not the men they worked with. If you are earning $650 an hour in Toronto as a top lawyer, and your client in Japan phones you at 4 a.m. on a Sunday, you answer now. You answer now, even if you have just gone back to sleep after feeding the baby. You answer because some hyper-ambitious legal associate in New York would be happy to answer if you don't. And that's why the market defines the work. The increasingly short supply of university-educated men poses a problem of increasing severity for women who want to marry as well as date. First, women have a strong proclivity to marry across or up the economic dominance hierarchy. They prefer a partner of equal or greater status. This holds true cross-culturally. The same does not hold, by the way, for men, who are perfectly willing to marry across or down, as the Pew data indicate, although they show a preference for somewhat younger mates. The recent trend towards the hollowing out of the middle class has also been increasing as resource-rich women tend more and more to partner with resource-rich men. Because of this, and because of the decline in high-paying manufacturing jobs for men, one of six men of employable age is currently without work in the U.S., marriage is now something increasingly reserved for the rich. I can't help finding that amusing in a blackly ironic manner. The oppressive patriarchal institution of marriage has now become a luxury. Why would the rich tyrannize themselves? Why do women want an employed partner and, preferably, one of higher status? In no small part, it's because women become more vulnerable when they have children. They need someone competent to support mother and child when that becomes necessary. It's a perfectly rational, compensatory act, although it may also have a biological basis. Why would a woman who decides to take responsibility for one or more infants want an adult to look after as well? So, the unemployed working man is an undesirable specimen, and single motherhood an undesirable alternative. Children in father-absent homes are four times as likely to be poor. That means their mothers are poor, too. Fatherless children are at much greater risk for drug and alcohol abuse. Children living with married, biological parents are less anxious, depressed, and delinquent than children living with one or more non-biological parent. Children in single-parent families are also twice as likely to commit suicide. The strong turn towards political correctness in universities has exacerbated the problem. The voices shouting against oppression have become louder, it seems, in precise proportion to how equal, even now increasingly skewed against men, the schools have become. There are whole disciplines in universities forthrightly hostile towards men. These are the areas of study dominated by the postmodern / neo-Marxist claim that Western culture in particular is an oppressive structure created by white men to dominate and exclude women and other select groups, successful only because of that domination and exclusion. The patriarchy, hindrance or help? Of course, culture is an oppressive structure. It's always been that way. It's a fundamental, universal, existential reality. The tyrannical king is a symbolic truth, an archetypal constant. What we inherit from the past is willfully blind and out of date. It's a ghost, a machine, and a monster. It must be rescued, repaired, and kept at bay by the attention and effort of the living. It crushes as it hammers us into socially acceptable shape, and it wastes great potential. But it offers great gain, too. Every word we speak is a gift from our ancestors. Every thought we think was thought previously by someone smarter. The highly functional infrastructure that surrounds us, particularly in the West, is a gift from our ancestors. The comparatively uncorrupt political and economic systems, the technology, the wealth, the lifespan, the freedom, the luxury, and the opportunity. Culture takes with one hand, but in some fortunate places it gives more with the other. To think about culture only as oppressive is ignorant and ungrateful, as well as dangerous. This is not to say, as I am hoping the content of this book has made abundantly clear so far, that culture should not be subject to criticism. Consider this as well in regard to oppression. Any hierarchy creates winners and losers. The winners are, of course, more likely to justify the hierarchy and the losers to criticize it. But, number one, the collective pursuit of any valued goal produces a hierarchy, as some will be better and some worse at that pursuit, no matter what it is. And number two, it is the pursuit of goals that in large part lends life its sustaining meaning. We experience almost all the emotions that make life deep and engaging as a consequence of moving successfully towards something deeply desired and valued. The price we pay for that involvement is the inevitable creation of hierarchies of success, while the inevitable consequence is difference in outcome. Absolute equality would therefore require the sacrifice of value itself, and then there would be nothing worth living for. We might instead note with gratitude that a complex, sophisticated culture allows for many games and many successful players, and that a well-structured culture allows the individuals that compose it to play and to win in many different fashions. It is also perverse to consider culture the creation of men. Culture is symbolically, archetypally, mythically male. That's partly why the idea of the patriarchy is so easily swallowed. But it is certainly the creation of humankind, not the creation of men, let alone white men, who nonetheless contributed their fair share. European culture has only been dominant, to the degree that it is dominant at all, for about 400 years. On the timescale of cultural evolution, which is to be measured at minimum in thousands of years, such a time span barely registers. Furthermore, even if women contributed nothing substantial to art, literature, and the sciences prior to the 1960s and the feminist revolution, which is not something I believe, then the role they played raising children and working on the farms was still instrumental in raising boys and freeing up men, a very few men, so that humanity could propagate itself and strive forward. Here's an alternative theory. Throughout history, men and women both struggled terribly for freedom from the overwhelming horrors of privation and necessity. Women were often at a disadvantage during that struggle, as they had all the vulnerabilities of men, with the extra reproductive burden and less physical strength. In addition to the filth, misery, disease, starvation, cruelty, and ignorance that characterized the lives of both sexes back before the 20th century, when even people in the Western world typically existed on less than a dollar a day in today's money, women also had to put up with the serious practical inconvenience of menstruation, the high probability of unwanted pregnancy, the chance of death or serious damage during childbirth, and the burden of too many young children. Perhaps that is sufficient reason for the different legal and practical treatment of men and women that characterized most societies prior to the recent technological revolutions, including the invention of the birth control pill. At least such things might be taken into account before the assumption that men tyrannized women is accepted as a truism. It looks to me like the so-called oppression of the patriarchy was instead an imperfect collective attempt by men and women stretching over millennia to free each other from privation, disease, and drudgery. The recent case of Arunachalam Muruganantham provides a salutary example. This man, the tampon king of India, became unhappy because his wife had to use dirty rags during her menstrual period. She told him it was either expensive sanitary napkins or milk for the family. He spent the next 14 years in a state of insanity, by his neighbor's judgment, trying to rectify the problem. Even his wife and his mother abandoned him briefly, terrified as they became of his obsession. When he ran out of female volunteers to test his product, he took to wearing a bladder of pig's blood as a replacement. I can't see how this behavior would have improved his popularity or status. Now his low-cost and locally made napkins are distributed across India, manufactured by women-run self-help groups. His users have been provided with freedom they never previously experienced. In 2014, this high school dropout was named one of Time magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. I am unwilling to consider personal gain Muruganantham's primary motivation. Is he part of the patriarchy? In 1847, James Young Simpson used ether to help a woman who had a deformed pelvis give birth. Afterwards, he switched to the better-performing chloroform. The first baby delivered under its influence was named Anesthesia. By 1853, chloroform was esteemed enough to be used by Queen Victoria, who delivered her seventh baby under its influence. Remarkably soon afterward, the option of painless childbirth was available everywhere. A few people warned of the danger of opposing God's pronouncement to women in Genesis 3:16, "I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children." Some also opposed its use among males. Young, healthy, courageous men simply did not need anesthesia. Such opposition was ineffectual. Use of anesthesia spread with extreme rapidity and far faster than would be possible today. Even prominent churchmen supported its use. The first practical tampon, Tampax, didn't arrive until the 1930s. It was invented